Welcome to episode 63. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with community health. On Monday, we returned to the Fair Work Commission to continue bargaining with the assistance of Commissioner Cribb for allied health professionals. We do appreciate the attendance of members at those sessions, and we'll be providing a report back to members with respect to that at our monthly meeting on Wednesday of this week. That meeting is for community health HR and IR managers. It is our monthly meeting on the third Wednesday of each month. We do encourage the people to attend this week. It's a particularly important point where we have proposals for response, and it's a great opportunity for community health members to give their feedback with respect to those proposals. With respect to our health service members, there is a reference group for biomedical engineers scheduled for Monday. There's an extraordinary reference group meeting on the dental health EBA, and the purpose of that meeting is really to talk through some of the potential productivity measures that might be identified. We're meeting, as we do on a regular basis, with DHHS on Tuesday. There's a mental health reference group meeting on Wednesday. We're also attending the opening of the ANMF's new building on Wednesday, which will be opened by the Premier Daniel Andrews. A Nurses and Midwives SDPPWG is scheduled for Thursday. In addition, there's also a reference group meeting for allied health professionals on that day. And we're also scheduled to attend the Small Rural Nurse Executive Forum on Friday. There's also a meeting that day with regards to the Nurse Unit Manager Review. We're still waiting to hear with respect to the Doctors and Training and Medical Specialists Agreement from the Fair Work Commission, and the same is also true with respect to the Maintenance Agreement. However, with regards to the Doctors' Agreements, we're now finalising the dates for the EBA forums, which will occur during June and July. We'll have details of those dates shortly, as well as locations, but it will be a mix of metropolitan and rural locations, and we will be taping one of those EBA forums so that that material is available to members who are unable to attend. As always, all of our industry activities are summarised on the VHA Community app, and that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. And joining me for this week's discussion is Senior Workplace Relations Consultant Daniel Pullen. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, Stuart.
Daniel, would you be good enough to reveal the clue for this week's subject for discussion?
Of course.
And I might just get you to hold that up and show that to the camera. And for the benefit of those people who are listening to this podcast rather than watching, could you describe the object?
It's an empty wooden picture frame.
And so I don't want to be unfair to you, and in order to make this clue effective, what I need to get you to do is to lift that up and put it just about there. And could you tell me what it is that you see?
I see you.
That's incorrect, Daniel. The correct answer is that you see me. And that brings us to this week's subject for discussion, CME, Continuing Medical Education Allowance. First of all, let's put that in context. Which agreement are we talking about when we're talking about CME?
The new Medical Specialist Agreement.
And in terms of the location of the CME allowance within that agreement?
It's Clause 41.
So that's located in Clause 41 for those people who are reading along at home. Let's just start with the purpose of CME.
Of course. So Continuing Medical Education Allowance is paid to reimburse doctors for costs that are reasonably incurred in the course of continuing medical education. And those activities or purposes have to be directly relevant to a doctor's employment within that health service.
So reimbursement of costs that are reasonably incurred with respect to CME activities. Okay, so what's an example then of a CME activity if somebody is not familiar with that?
So for example, a doctor who specialises in paediatric medicine who wants to attend a leading paediatric medicine conference in London to further their education, and the doctor then seeks reimbursement for the costs reasonably incurred in the course of that activity.
So the elements there, they're attending a conference, it is to further their medical education, it is directly relevant to their employment, therefore it is a CME activity. I remember during the course of the negotiations, and I don't think this is betraying any confidence, that the AMA described CME as a clause that punches above its weight. Is it accurate to suggest that there was a large amount of time spent during the negotiations on this particular provision?
Look, that's an accurate suggestion. From our discussions with the AMA, their member representatives who attended bargaining in our own reference groups, this is a clause that, you know, ordinarily operates correctly across the sector. But where it operates and doesn't succeed in operating correctly, it's memorable for all parties involved.
Yes, that's a really good description, that it sticks in the memory for that minority of cases where there is an issue and people tend to get emotionally invested. So a good familiarity with this clause and how it operates and processes for dealing with claims and resolving disputes are especially important. And it's also quite a unique provision. We don't really have a comparable provision in other agreements.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, we've talked about the summary for the purpose of what CME is. Let's start by summarising some of the changes to CME and starting with the quantum of that allowance.
For sure. So the CME reimbursement cap is subject to the 3% uplift that applies to allowances as provided in the agreement. The CME reimbursement cap is currently $25,077. Once the agreement comes into effect, the cap will be $25,829 for the 2017-18 financial year.
So just to pick you up on something, Daniel, you referred to it being increased by 3%. One of the interesting features of the specialists agreement is that there is also a bump up with the first by an additional 6%. Do I understand correctly that 6% does not apply to CME?
Correct.
So it's the general 3% per annum amounts that will index the CME allowance.
Correct.
So there'll be a change of about $752 as a reimbursable cap.
That's correct.
And what will the caps be during the life of the agreement?
So the CME reimbursement caps are prescribed on page 90 of the Medical Specialist Agreement, and they are for the 2018 and 2019 financial year, $26,604. For the 2019 to 2020 financial year, $27,402. And for the 2020 to 2021 financial year, it's $28,224.
So from memory, Daniel, the agreement, both past and present, provided an indicative list of reimbursable expenses. Before we get to the changes, can we cover off what's in that list?
Sure. So prior to the changes, there a doctor is entitled to seek reimbursement for CME-related costs reasonably incurred within their CME activity. And this would include registration fees for these conferences, reasonable travel, accommodation, and per diem expenses, the registration costs associated with short courses, workshops, postgraduate courses that are recognised by their specialty college for the purposes of attaining CME or CPD points, and other costs such as books, CDs, portable technological aids and subscriptions where such resources are not provided by the health service.
CDs. I think next time I doubt we'll be talking about CDs, but we may be talking about vinyl. Just in terms of changes, though, to that list of, and these are indicative, it's an indicative list as opposed to an exhaustive list.
Correct.
What are the changes to that indicative list?
So the changes that have been introduced are that the CME can be utilised for a reimbursable expense that's linked to an approved sabbatical leave period, and that's only where this sabbatical leave is arranged and approved in accordance with Clause 57 of this agreement. In addition, the registration cost of relevant specialist medical colleges and or associations, however they are titled or styled, in the medical field within which the doctor is credentialed and practicing.
Okay, there's a fairly significant connection then between that expansion as being directly connected to the work they do.
Correct.
One of the recurring themes for that set of negotiations, Daniel, were really bringing that agreement up to date, and in particular reforming that agreement to ensure that barriers to participation were removed, particularly in the context of barriers to participation for those with parental responsibilities. Did that issue find its way into the new CME clause?
Look, it did. There are additional entitlements for where a person, a doctor that is undertaking CME, who is also a primary carer of a child during that period, can access a $250 per day per diem, which is provided for them to attain childcare or other associated costs. The reason why this was agreed between the parties is that the parties did agree that a primary carer of a child would experience a greater difficulty in accessing CME, especially in relation to, you know, interstate or overseas travel.
So people should look to clause 41.3 for the details with regards to that that per day payment.
Correct.
So just to recap, where a doctor is the primary carer responsible for a child or children during the day of the CME activity period, they'll be paid a fixed amount of $250 per day.
That's correct.
So they don't need to provide evidence of a cost incurred?
Look, they don't, but they need to provide evidence that satisfies a reasonable person that they are the primary carer and that they are responsible for the child or children during the CME activity period.
I think the important thing to re-emphasise there that this is about removing a barrier to access to that entitlement.
Yeah.
So I understand one of the things that our members were keen to achieve in the new agreement was an extension of the period that was available to assess CME claims. So the previous agreement requires that the process be resolved entirely within 30 days. Was that quest for an extended period of time successful?
Look, it was. And we were able to achieve for members an additional 15 days to be included. And we've also been able to obtain exceptions in the calculation of how many days a health service has to respond to a claim or assess a claim to remove public holidays and the day of receipt from the calculation. And we hope this assists members during the Easter and Christmas New Year period where there are multiple public holidays in quick succession.
So notwithstanding that there has been that change to the timeframe, there are also some additional steps that must occur within that 45 days for health services to undertake. Could we just identify what those steps are within the assessment period?
So we've got a three-step process, and the first step is the assessment period. Once a claim is received, the health service is provided 30 days, which doesn't include the day of receipt or any public holidays, to assess the claim and determine whether the claim is inconsistent or consistent with the clause and whether it necessitates inquiry. Where the health service deems the claim is consistent with the CME clause, the reimbursement must be processed no later than 45 days from the date from which it was received.
So generally speaking, this clause has been sort of redrafted for clarity of expression, and in particular, these steps have been sort of set out in hopefully a clearer fashion. People can find them at clause 41.4. You gave that example of there being an assessment period. What happens if an employer requires more information?
So where the health service deems that the claim is inconsistent with the CME clause and it necessitates inquiry, the health service must inform the doctor in writing of his intention to reject the claim and provide the doctor an opportunity to respond in writing. If the health service fails to write to the doctor within the 30 days within that assessment period, the health service must reimburse the doctor the full amount of the claim to the limit of the doctor's outstanding CME balance within 45 days of receipt.
So returning to that circumstance where a health service during that 30-day assessment period determines that more information is required and writes to the doctor, what is the process that's adopted to determine the outcome?
So following the doctor being written to and provided an opportunity to respond, the health service has to deem whether the following the additional material or the additional information is provided by the doctor, they need to determine whether the claim is consistent with the CME clause. If it is, they must notify the doctor in writing within 7 days of receipt of the doctor's response and reimburse the doctor within 45 days of receiving that doctor's response.
Okay, interesting. It's connected to the quicker the doctor responds, the quicker they're likely to be reimbursed in the event that it's a compliant claim. But there seems to be a heavy emphasis there on making sure that it's assessed quite quickly.
Correct.
And determined quite quickly as to whether the additional information takes it to that point of compliance or not, and to keep it moving.
That's correct.
So we've covered off what happens in the event that the additional information helps clarify and determine that the claim is compliant. Have to ask the question, what happens if Having received that additional information, the employer is still of the view that the claim is not complied.
So in that circumstance, the health service must notify the doctor in writing of the outcome within 7 days of the receipt of the response. So very similar to if the claim has been clarified and the claim is deemed to be consistent with the clause, there is still a 7 day time frame within within which the health service must respond to the doctor's response. If it's refused, for those grounds, and the grounds would be detailed in the correspondence to the doctor, it will be open to the doctor to utilise the dispute resolution procedure within the agreement to dispute the outcome and the determination of the health service.
So notwithstanding that the CME, there's a lot of it that hasn't changed. There are those subtle changes where there are some changes to, in some instances, the scope or some of the things that can be claimed, and that the timeframes have changed. Under those circumstances, notwithstanding that it's quite similar to what was there before, would you recommend that people review their processes to ensure compliance?
Yeah, I would agree.
And I understand that the period within which the doctor must submit their claims has been altered.
That's correct. So the agreement now provides that claims are to be submitted within the financial year in which the expense is incurred, but it also extends the deadline for submission to no later than 3 months from the end of the financial year from which they relate.
So I think previously it was 3 months from when it was incurred. Now they've got to the end of financial year, and indeed 3 months from the end of the financial year. So they've got really until the 30th of September.
Correct.
And one of the matters that was raised by the AMA during bargaining was the treatment of FBT, where a doctor took annual leave either side of a conference. And this was particularly in the context of flights. So for those members who may not be familiar with that particular issue, could you just speak to that a little bit?
So if we use the example of our learned friend, the doctor who specialises in paediatric medicine.
Who's gone to London.
Correct, and they're attending a paediatric conference in London. So there's no question that the attendance to the CME event is compliant and is otherwise approved by the health service. But if the doctor decides to take a week of annual leave after the conference, some health services were reducing the reimbursement of that doctor's airfare by 50% as a method to offset any fringe benefit tax obligations incurred.
Okay, so people were mixing up the obligations under the industrial instrument, which are about what you reimburse, and the potential for an FBT cost.
That's correct. So the method that they were adopting is incorrect. Health service must reimburse a doctor up to their CME reimbursement cap, and any applicable fringe benefit tax that's incurred is deducted from the doctor's CME reimbursement cap.
Okay, so in the event that FBT is incurred, it is deducted from the cap.
Correct.
We also had lots of discussions around flights during the course of those negotiations. And one of the examples that sticks in my mind concerns that rule with regards to business class airfares and journeys. That is that if a journey is, I think, was it greater than 3 hours?
Correct.
A journey greater than 3 hours can be as a business class flight and with journeys that are shorter than that, not being business class. As such, the example that was given were circumstances where people had connecting flights. So a person might be on their way to, let's stick with our paediatrician, heading to London, and their first flight is from Melbourne to Sydney, but it's part of a much longer journey, which is well beyond 3 hours, and whether that leg of the journey should be available as a business class flight or not.
So the parties agreed that it would be consistent with the clause that the doctor is provided the ability to access business class airfares for business class airfares for that the whole journey. The journey itself would exceed a 3 hour journey, and the parties agreed that using that example, the Melbourne to Sydney segment of that journey should be reimbursed for business class airfares.
So that term journey is a broader term than flight.
Correct.
As such, but it is predicated on the fact that the person has in fact incurred the cost of a business class airfare. That is, a person can't fly economy and claim business class.
Correct.
Okay. So finally, we spoke earlier about removing some of the barriers that exist to people with parental responsibilities and women with parental responsibilities to accessing entitlements, including CME entitlements. Are there any other provisions relevant to that issue under the CME clause?
There is. So now the agreement provides that where a doctor is prevented from using their CME entitlement in a particular financial year due to parental leave, family or caring responsibilities, personal illness or injury, or another exceptional circumstance that's accepted as such by a health service, they may carry over any unused component of their CME support entitlement into the next financial year, provided that the doctor has provided the health service with evidence that satisfies a reasonable person.
Satisfies a reasonable person. So that really moves away from the traditional use it or lose it model that we've had, but really intersects with the fact that there are circumstances where a person will not have a reasonable opportunity to access that entitlement. So let's take an example. A doctor who is absent for 9 months of a financial year due to parental leave, under that circumstance, can they carry forward an unused component of CME into the next financial year?
So they could, utilising the provisions within this new clause.
And in terms of evidence that would satisfy a reasonable person?
I think it will be a little more tangible by way of a small child.
A small child is fairly irrefutable evidence. Daniel, thank you for taking me through the CME clause as it's been modified. And where can people find more information with regards to this clause?
So we've provided members with an implementation guide which will reflect additional material with respect to how to implement this clause. But in addition to that, we'll be providing links to frequently asked questions on the VHA community app.
And as always, if members do have questions with regards to an agreement, we would encourage them to post their questions on the VHA community app.
Correct.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you, Stuart.